The House Committee on Healthcare and open an informational meeting on healthcare licensing boards. And the question today, what we're looking at today is the beginning of the discussion of what oversight is there for the functions of boards that license health professionals. And we've asked the governor's staff to join us today and talk to us about what the governor perceives, or at least the governor's staff, and you don't necessarily speak for the governor, what the governor's staff perceives as their role in, and I would hope we'll talk about their role in ordinary circumstances and then their role in extraordinary circumstances like the nursing board debacle that happened last year. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Amber Hollister. I'm the Deputy General Counsel in the Office of the Governor. Thank you for the invitation to testify today. I'm prepared to testify about the appointments process, and I've also prepared a chart for your reference of many of the health licensing boards. I've tried to include all of them, but I might have missed one or two, so my apologies on that. The chart, you should all have a copy of it. List the board, the relevant statutes, the method of appointment, whether there's confirmation by the Senate or otherwise, as well as any terms for removal. So with that, I'm happy to begin. In seeking candidates to fill vacancies on health licensing boards, the governor's office first reaches out to develop a list of potential candidates. We do this through a variety of methods. We, of course, have our website. We sometimes will list ads in professional publications. We'll speak with current board and commission members to see if they know anyone who would be appropriate, as well as professional organizations. Several boards, as you know, have statutory provisions that require the governor to receive names from certain professional associations, such as the Board of Dentistry, requires that. Sometimes we just get cold calls from folks. Our executive appointments director, Nancy Gosteran, is great at dealing with those. And I should actually mention here, she is unfortunately ill today and is unable to be here, so my apologies. She's at home, I think, listening to the audio stream of this hearing. She won't entirely miss out. So we also seek volunteers through conventions, trainings, and other events. So that's where we start with the appointment process. As I'm sure many of you realize, we expect that this process could become a little more complicated given the recent enactment of Senate Bill 10, and because those provisions, the gift provisions especially, apply to board and commission members. So once we have sent out our feelers and developed a list of names, we then request applications or receive them unsolicited. There's actually an interest form on our website that allows folks to state their interest in a particular board and tell us whether they meet the qualifications of that board. We sometimes will review applications that were submitted previously. So it's a little bit like the state of Oregon. They keep your application on file forever, or close to it. And as far as reappointment is concerned, the governor routinely will reappoint an individual to serve a second term, if that's allowed under the statute. And in some circumstances, that doesn't happen just due to particular circumstances. But he does prefer to keep an experienced person on a board if that's the right decision. As far as making the actual decision to appoint, as the chart points out, although many of the decisions are made by the governor, they often require the confirmation of the Senate. So what we'll do is we'll vet the names internally, both with the board itself and administrators and professional organizations, and then we'll submit a list of names to caucuses if there's a Senate approval required. The governor places a high priority on ensuring diversity on boards and commissions, and so he prefers to appoint members from a broad range of backgrounds, experiences, and perspectives, including ethnic, racial, geographic, and gender. We also, before we recommend someone, we do check their criminal history with the Oregon State Police, and we confirm that they're in compliance with the Department of Revenue. We don't have any tax problems brewing. We also speak with the policy folks. And if there's any legislators that have indicated an interest in that border commission, we touch bases with them as well. So it is a fairly complex process from the time that a vacancy becomes available to the time that we actually appoint a candidate or they appear before the Senate for confirmation. There have been occasions that we have submitted a name for confirmation, and we haven't been able to address concerns raised by legislators, in which case the governor has withdrawn names in the past. So that's the general process for appointment, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with that. And I guess I'll move now to the specific health licensing board information that you've requested today. And in referring to my chart, I'll note that, I guess it's three pages long, there are a few boards, I believe, that are missing here, but many of the ones we recognize are listed. The terms of health licensing boards range from 3 to 4 years. The four-year term is actually a constitutional limit that's imposed by Article 15 of the Oregon Constitution. So it's unsurprising that all the terms are less than 4 years. The removal provisions, as you would see by reviewing the chart, vary quite a bit. And this, as the governor's deputy counsel, when removal becomes an issue, this is where we look first to the statute. Of course, we want to comply and enforce the law. So in some instances, for example, the Board of Examiners of Nursing Home Administrators, the removal just is plainly written in the statute that a member serves at the pleasure of the governor, which means that we don't need to have a cause to remove a member of a board or commission. There's no, for instance, someone could have family concerns and be requested they be removed. We could decide there's a candidate in the community that would add something special and we really need their expertise, and we could replace someone with a new candidate. There's no need for any kind of misconduct in such a situation to replace a person on the board. There are many boards and commissions that by statute the individuals do serve at the pleasure of the governor. Let's see. The other common terms for removal are some variation of a member may be removed for cause. This is stated in a variety of ways. You can tell by reviewing the statute that it was clearly, they were written over time, and people said things differently. And so the challenge for the governor's office is to determine what these statutes mean in the absence of a lot of case law or authority. So we do our best to parse the statute and determine the standards for removal. Oftentimes there is a reference to some kind of misconduct, incompetence, or neglect of duty, but sometimes the statute will just state that an individual can be removed for cause. And that is a nebulous term. I think there are several cases that just describe it as the unknown. So that can be a challenge as well, working from inside the governor's office. Finally, there's also one other removal statute or type of removal statute, and I actually only found it for the State Board of Pharmacy. Under that provision, there's actually a full Oregon Administrative Procedures Act contested case hearing required, which I'm a former litigator. It's essentially a trial. So, I mean, when you look at a contested case hearing, it's very formal. It's also very expensive. And that's what's required to remove an individual. So, and then the final type of removal statute is silence. Essentially, there are a lot of these a lot of these boards that do not specify when and why someone should be removed for cause or otherwise. In Article 15, I think it's Clause 2 of the Oregon State Constitution, it does state that if an individual is appointed to a board or commission that doesn't have a specified term, then that individual serves at the pleasure of the appointing power. But in these instances, you'll see from the chart, there are terms specified for every single board or commission. So we clearly would not fall under that. So I suppose it's, in that case, it's up for interpretation whether silence means that someone can only be removed for cause. There's definitely authority that suggests that, but I'm not in a position to interpret.
You're not?
Well, I guess that's the court's job, I guess is what I should say. The courts will ultimately determine what that means. There's definitely case law that suggests that it will mean that there's only removal for cause. So as soon as there's a case on point, I'd be happy to point it out to you. So I think that concludes my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Can I push on the cause question a little bit? I mean,
yes.
And some of them is very specific. It's cause of something that was done by an individual.
Mm-hmm.
Could cause be that the board is just screwing up as a board? The governor wants to remove everybody for that cause?
Well, I need to premise my comments, and please forgive me that under the statute I'm not allowed to give any of you legal advice. Only legislative counsel can.
Thank
so, of course, you know that starting at that point. For cause, the one thing I can tell you is it's usually interpreted to mean something that's related to the administration or the office, the particular tasks that board or commission member has been appointed to perform. So if I think your hypothetical was that just a board is not functioning as a board.
Well, my hypothetical related specifically to the nursing board, where there was clear evidence that the administrative arm of the agency was not performing adequately. There were two audits to prove that. And since the board, since the administrative staff reports to the board, could it have been construed that the board was malfunctioning, was not doing its oversight responsibility for the agency, and therefore the whole board was at cause?
Mr. Chair.
Is that a feasible? I was wondering whether I don't want to ask you whether you explored that in discussions of what to deal with, but would that be a feasible hypothesis that would obviously end up probably being settled in the courts, but it is an action that the governor might declare?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I need to, give you a quick disclaimer before I answer that question. I
can give it to everyone.
We
will stipulate your disclaimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I became the governor's deputy general counsel on January 7th, 2008. So, unfortunately, I've not been here. I was not here for the Board of Nursing. I think that the experience that you're referencing. So I'm going to answer from my own experience. And I hope that, or my own knowledge of the law, and I hope that that's sufficient. So your question is whether a board as a whole isn't functioning, whether that might lead to the determination that there's cause to replace the members of the board
exactly,
as a whole.
That's exactly my question.
And it seems to me that, of course, you know, you would need to look at the particular circumstances. But I would say that generally, if the entire board is not functioning, then each individual on the board likely has some part in that. And you'd have to look at the circumstances. Whether that's cause or not, I think, is another question.
Cause is
I think, a higher standard than just then there's things could be done better, I guess. We need to look at the individual and look at whether they have somehow committed misconduct or failed to perform their duties. And I think that would need to be we would need to make some specific findings.
Yeah, well, under, for example, respiratory therapists, it specifically talks about remove for neglect of duty,
mm-hmm.
incompetence, or unethical or dishonorable conditions. There would be many of us that would have accused that board of incompetence. But I don't know whether this respiratory therapist board is a particular definition of cause or not.
Well, my reading of cause is that it includes incompetence.
Okay.
That's one
question.
Of the types of cause that you could find, but I wouldn't want to limit it to that.
No, I understand. Representative Maher?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. In the last 24 hours, it became very clear that we are stirring up a hornet's nest. Not in today's hearing per se, but in the question that you asked for tomorrow's hearing, should a majority of the...
Oh, I'm sure that'll get it. Yes, right. But that was my intention with a long stick, though. And I didn't want to get too close to that hornet's nest.
Yeah. which is fine. I think that we need to have a plan on how we want to approach some of these issues so we are efficient in how we move through this process. And an example on tomorrow's question about whether the majority of the board should be public members, I think is, you know, clearly that's putting a hornet nest on your head. So, but
funny, I haven't been bitten yet. Have you?
I haven't been bitten, but I've had questions and from multiple people, I think that in an example of removal, and this was my knee jerk reaction on the nursing board, was my jaw hit the floor when it came to me or came light to me that the governor did not have. There had to be cause in the Board of Nursing. And I would have assumed that the governor, because it is a political appointment, that it would have been...
It's an administrative appointment, I think.
Well, okay. It's an executive
appointment. Yeah.
But it's still through a political process because it's a governor who's politically appointed or elected in the legislative Senate. But the point is start with a default position that the governor serves at the pleasure of the governor and allow the boards to tell us why that is not a good position to be on. And because I think that is kind of a more middle ground position. And I would be very interested why they would pull us off that position. But that is an issue of standardization that I think should be clearly across the boards. But board membership is a different issue. And what areas are
across the board too? Right?
What areas are we going to attack, or are we going to focus on? Because this is a huge piece, and I don't think we're going to swallow the whole apple in 2009. But what are the things that we can reasonably expect to do and truly have an impact on the public safety?
Well, I would like to have an omnibus bill ready for pre-session filing that looks at various questions, what's in it and what the outcome is and all that. We have a long way to go to get that. And you ask a fair question, at least in terms of me. I don't have a plan. So I love to read mysteries, and there are detectives who say their main, when they don't have a clue of what to do to solve the mystery, is they go poking in hornet's nests to see what flies up and get a clue that way. I think we have until say about October, I guess, to create some package that we can all support. And I think it needs to be in several of these areas. And while I put forth as a hypothesis that the public should be a majority on any board, public members should be a majority, I don't necessarily imagine that's where we'll come out. But I think we need to ask it that way. We need to present, as a scientist, a null hypothesis to guide us into where we might end up. And where I know we need to end up is with more public representation than we have now in some uniform way across the board. The question is how much more and how do we state it and how do we get there? But, yeah, there's no plan underlying all
that. Okay.
It's just banging around. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question that I don't think involves hornet's nests, but that's related to Representative Maurer's question. Amber, when you were putting this together, did you find it's pretty clear that there's a lot of differences among the boards, especially in the removal provisions. Are we an anomaly, or do other states have that much difference between and among their licensing boards, or are they more consistent? You know, we have everything from no terms to the contested case to cause. Have other states sort of made their licensing boards more consistent than ours are?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I unfortunately did not survey other states' laws on this. I would be surprised if every state has a system as complex as ours, but I've not looked at that at this time. It's a very good question.
Thank you.
Mr. Powers, did you survey? Give me the answer to this, that question. If you do. Yeah, if you do have something. Okay. Tom has reviewed various things across the states, but this may not be a particular issue. Representative Cote?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here today, Ms. Halster. A question about following up on Representative Maurer's comments about consistency. I'm looking for the downside. What would be the downside of, for example, having all of these appointed by the governor with confirmation by the Senate? Confirmation by the Senate would provide some public check on the governor's appointments. We'd have consistency across the board. Is there any upside to just being appointed by? I'm just trying to figure out why we wouldn't want to do that kind of consistency from your experience.
We're not doing any confirmation.
We're not doing any.
No, I mean, either way.
Either way, it could just be appointed by the governor, but.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Kotak, I think that it's a question of time and efficiency. I agree that there are benefits to having a confirmation by the Senate, that the candidate is more thoroughly vetted, perhaps, by the legislature, which is definitely adds value. On the other hand, as we've seen this session, the legislature is very busy, the Senate's very busy, it might be just an unnecessary step. I know that there is a very long list of candidates for boards and commissions that do require confirmation by the Senate, and Ms. Gasseran has been presenting many candidates this session. So I think perhaps that the members might be in a better position to evaluate what added value there is to confirmation by the Senate.
Thanks. Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Amber. Perhaps, I apologize if you sort of covered this already, but could you help distinguish between these various removal criteria? Which gives the governor the greatest latitude? If you could sort of help classify them, for which of these boards does the governor have the most latitude with respect to removal? For which is it the least? When no terms are specified, does that mean the governor has the sort of greatest power? Does specifying terms actually have the effect of limiting the governor's authority with respect to removal? Help sort of classify these, if you could.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, I'm happy to address that. On the end of providing the most discretion to the governor, I would say there's two scenarios that provide equal discretion. One is when there's a term specified, but the statute also provides that the individual serves at the pleasure of the governor. The other instance would be where there's no term specified, and there's also no provision regarding removal, in which case the fallback is the Article 15 Section 2 analysis, which says that means they serve at the pleasure of the appointing power. And so that would be the most flexibility.
Can you actually point to specific commissions that reflect what you're describing?
Sure.
Since we have it in front of us, you could
Mr. Chair,
sort of notate right there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, I'm happy to do that. Here, there's several boards. If you look at the top of the chart, the Board of Examiners of Nursing Homes, as well as on the next page, the Oregon Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists, as well as the State Board of Clinical Social Workers, the Board of Examiners for Speech-Language Pathology, and the State Massage Therapists Board. They all serve at the pleasure or the option of the governor. I think option is probably fairly similar to pleasure. There are no instances in this list of a case where there's no term specified. If we were to go to a broader list of board and commission members, I think that we could find one, but I don't know that off the top of my head, unfortunately. So that's the least restrictive, the most power for the governor, most discretion.
Okay. And on the other end of the spectrum, or if you could help us sort through the rest of these?
Well, I mean, you go to the physical therapy board, it says it requires a request of the board for the governor to remove somebody for cause. That's about as weird as it gets.
Yeah,
it's not as weird as it gets, right?
No, I agree.
That's pretty weird.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon. So probably in the middle of the road section would be, I think there's some of these removal clauses that specify, instead of just saying for cause, they give some specific examples of what cause is. I think you could argue that would be, it would be easier to remove someone in such circumstances because it's well defined, but I could see it the other way as well, that saying for cause is, gives you more flexibility. But I'd say that the for cause bucket of where it says for cause or where it says for misconduct or neglect or list something to that effect is sort of the midline discretion where we have to find a discrete reason before someone is removed from a board or commission. And then I would say the very most restrictive is, as Representative Bonamici pointed out, there are these instances where a full contested case is required, which is the mini trial that the Board of Pharmacy requires.
And I'm sorry, where it says no term specified, how would you evaluate that?
That's a great question, Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon. When there's no term specified, that I think we can interpret that to mean, we interpret that to mean for cause, because there is a term on these positions. Earlier I referenced Article 15, Section 2 of the Oregon Constitution, which states that if there is no term, then an individual serves at the pleasure of the appointing authority. So we interpret that to apply to the reverse, in essence, that if a term is specified and no standard is given, then that means that you're not serving just at the pleasure, that cause is required to remove an individual.
So you would, in your analysis is that, for instance, the Board of Medical Examiners, where no terms are specified, you look at the governor's discretion there essentially the same way as you would the Board of Nursing, where it says the governor may remove a member for cause.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, that's correct. And one way to think of this, maybe to order it, is when the statute says someone serves at the pleasure of the governor, if we need to remove them, then we just remove them. We let them know you've been removed. And there's no more process required. When someone is going to be removed for cause, oftentimes something called a name-clearing hearing needs to be held. And frankly, we don't really know what that looks like in the context of government of individuals appointed by the governor. It could be the member of the Board or Commission sitting down in front of the governor and arguing their case. It could be delegated to someone like me to sit down and listen to the individual's concerns. And because this is a due process analysis, it's not as black and white as we'd like it to be. So there's the for cause process is murky. The contested case hearing, the Oregon APA lays out how that procedure unfolds clearly, but it's very difficult.
And final question: Do you agree with the chair that on the physical therapists board this requirement that it would appear to read that in order to for the governor to remove a member of the physical therapist licensing board, the request has to originate at the board? Is that the way you read this as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, let me just flip to the statute that pertains to that so I make sure I'm seeing it in context. So I'm looking at ORS 688-160.
We work with that statute quite a bit. That's a pretty complex statute. We work with it far more than we want to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, in looking at the language of the statute, Again, I would have to say I'd need to look at the circumstances of any case before applying the law. But I would say that there's still a residual power of the governor to remove an individual for cause. Under Article 10, he's charged with executing the laws under the Constitution. And if a person is getting in the way of that, and you know, if there's some sort of blatant misconduct, I would say that the governor still has the power to remove them.
I'm sure the governor will appreciate your advocating for his executive authority.
I'm not impressed that the governor wants to remove anybody. It's a difficult process. I don't think it's an easy. I mean, I don't think it's a psychologically easy thing to do to pull somebody off a board. I think that's hard. Mm-hmm. Representative Kota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember what I wanted to ask. Well, this is fascinating.
This
to me.
Gets worse with age.
Well, I would love to have the legislative history on some of these, because all I'm thinking is, wow, they had some pretty good lobbyists. You know, you know, if we decide to go to, for example, consistency and say a member serves at the pleasure of the governor, period, to provide that flexibility with maybe a legislative safeguard in the appointment process, I wouldn't mind hearing from some of these with very specific removal processes to have them argue why they should keep them. Because I, you know, is there something about the State Board of Pharmacy that they somehow have a higher standard and the BME has nothing? I'm like, that's crazy. So I would be curious. In fact, I would put a note, a call out to the folks who are watching this. Let us know why you think you should keep the process you have it if it is that expansive. So.
Yeah, I suspect we're going to get this when we propose some very specific alternatives. I think we'll then begin to hear what people think about it. Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was thinking about that, what might be the downfall to serving at the pleasure of the governor, and I'm wondering if you had a situation where a governor perhaps might have an agenda around a certain board. I would think that pharmacy might be one of those boards that would be very tempting to have some agendas around, whether or not it is important to have some sort of a safeguard there to protect the independence of that board and decisions that they might make.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we get into political things. I think we had that with the Fish and Wildlife Commission at one point, and a while back on individual appointees. I think the forestry, mm-hmm. something was. I mean, we've heard about this problem, but we don't usually hear about it with the health related boards as in terms of individual issues. But we could have.
Mr. Chair, well, for example, under the Patient Safety Commission, and some of these are commissions, and we might want to make the distinction between ones that are regulating
mm-hmm.
health providers, and but the fact that they say they can't have a wholesale removal, it might be a good safeguard, because it might get to that,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
you could remove a few folks, but you can't replace the entire board.
I think that was my statute. I wonder
was
why
that your
got into it. Yeah, I can't pack the court.
Hey, good lobbyist there.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point. These are frequently produced by consensus committees that I work on. In fact, I think this was specifically written. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, I would disagree with Representative Gelser. Not that I ever do that, but. I would disagree in the point that you know, we said these are executive appointments, but this is still a political process, and the governor has there is political capital, a political price to be paid for making those kinds of wholesale decisions that they would have to pay, and so they would have to balance their political agenda against what is reasonable, and it's not as if we don't have that example here now, and it just seems to me that in this case that the backstop that these boards do function fairly well, or they function very well as a general rule, and what would be the intent of a governor doing that? And if they did, then I think everybody would have pause as to why.
Be up in arms.
And, you know, an example might be in pharmacy, where you have some reason not to like the pharmaceutical industry. And so, if you want, you can go out and appoint people that are going to, you're going to find a pharmacist out there that doesn't like the pharmaceutical industry, so, you know, they can still manipulate that board over course of time. So.
Yeah, when I talk to the governor's appointment secretary, she points out that the real problem is finding enough people to be appointed to these positions. That's every position. I mean, almost every position is a bit of a struggle to get somebody, get the right person. That seems to be the biggest problem. Thank you. Okay, can I ask a broader question? If getting to that other issue, and maybe you're not the right one to answer it. Maybe you can send somebody back down. I really do wonder what the governor and the governor's staff think about their particular role in oversight of this huge amount of boards. Do they really believe that they have some responsibility for watching them? Is it only in crisis situations that this gets their attention? This is one of the things that a very specific thing we're grappling with is who has oversight on these boards? Are they completely independent without any oversight, or is there some place in the governor's office that has a feeling that they're watching out to make sure the physical therapy board is operating properly?
Mr. Chair, I think I can answer your question in part. But I may need to defer in part as well. I think that the governor's office does take its appointment power very seriously. I know that Ms. Gosseran, our appointments executive, she is extremely well-connected in the community and is quite successful at convincing people to serve on committees. And, of course, you know, to the great extent, individuals that are appointed do a fabulous job. And we're very proud of their work. In instances where there are problems, we hear about that in a variety of ways. Certainly through the state agencies that work with the boards and commissions, are appraised of how that group is, that the board or commission is functioning. Also through our connections with professional organizations, given information, inside information about how things are going. But we don't have a member of the governor's staff present at every board or commission meeting. So I don't, certainly there's not a extremely close degree of oversight. And I wish I could speak to the procedures we have in place for dealing with problems, but I'm just not in a position to do so.
Well, let me rephrase the question to be a more general question. And let me ask it in pieces. Is the operation of a board, any of these boards, is that a part of the executive function of our government?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the boards are created by the legislature. They're creatures of statute. So I think that's where we need to start. Certainly the power to appoint and the power to remove has been delegated to the governor in many instances. But again, the conditions of removal and the method for removal are dictated by the legislature. So I guess I can't say...
I'm not talking about removal.
Sure.
Let's forget about appointment removal. Let's put that aside. Let me make a point. I once asked to serve on a board, and I was told because it was an executive function, separation of powers didn't allow me to be named to that board because it was an executive function of the government rather than a legislative or a judicial. My understanding is most everything is either judicial, legislative, or executive. I can't at the moment think of anything that's not, but...
Mr. Chair, I think I understand what you're getting at. And I think that we do consider when we're making appointments that these boards fall under the broad umbrella of the executive branch. For instance, we will not appoint a member of the judiciary to serve on a board or commission for that very reason.
Well, if we start from that, is it also safe to assume that the governor is responsible for activities within the executive branch?
Well, certainly, Mr. Chair, certainly the governor is the head of the executive branch.
Charlie, you want to join this? We do have our lawyer with us today. Thank you.
Who are you, sir?
For the record, Charlie Sheik, Legislative Counsel. I have the responsibility for drafting and health regulatory boards. I've done so for the last 10 years.
The question I'm pushing at, and it's one we really need to take responsibility after, well, we just need to take responsibility for looking at the question is, who has the oversight responsibility for the behavior of a professional boards? And if we figure out who it is, the question is, how is that going to be? How do we want to see that oversight authority managed? And so the first thing is to look to the governor and to say, well, I mean, I think that's the first thing.
Yeah, Chair Greenlee, I would agree. I mean, these are executive appointments. These are executive branch agencies. And I think the overall responsibility lies with the head of the executive branch, the governor. If I may, I'd like to offer just an observation as I was listening to the conversation.
Please, any observations.
And I made a note saying that it really, as you start down this path, it's very important, I think, that we... or you, excuse me, address the dynamic between the legislative branch and the executive branch in relationship to this whole question. What authority do you as the legislature have in relationship to what you're delegating to the governor? And your question, I thought, in relationship to, do you wait till there's a problem before the governor, the executive branch responds, is very important, because my experience has been when there is a problem, it's your doors that the constituents come and knock on. I don't know how much knocking they do at the governor's office, but I know that they do plenty of knocking in this building. And your constituents, when there's a problem with the Board of Nursing or anywhere else, the Board of Chiropractic Examiners or whatever, they come to their legislators to ask for fixes. So that, to me, tells me that there's a big responsibility that you have, and it needs to be clear. And that's just a personal observation.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
it seems to me that we have three areas of oversight. Number one is we can legislate them out of existence. Number two is we give them the money to operate. If we don't like what they do, we can take their money away.
Like Fish and Wildlife, we threaten to do exactly
that's
that.
Most of the regulatory boards are supported by their license fees.
Okay.
That's correct.
Yeah, but we can still take it away.
Sure.
And three, we have performance measures that we have directed that each of these agencies' boards establish and report to us. And so...
But for example, everything you just said now is also true of, let's say, ODOT, or pick a department. I mean, pick a more traditional department. Any of those things can happen, but it's clear to us that the... No, ODOT, it isn't clear. ODOT, ODOT isn't clear because they report to the Transportation Commission. And then the question is, who has oversight over the Transportation Commission? It's precisely the same problem. But DHS reports to their director, who reports to the governor. And what makes DHS different than ODOT? There's one we can ask that's independent of all the health things we're talking about.
Of course, the answer is always money. Sources of funding.
Well, who has oversight to ODOT? I mean, who has oversight to the Transportation Commission, I think? Is that one of the things you fool around with?
I couldn't answer that question for you.
Well, I think this is a question we really need to be, if we're going to try and produce an omnibus bill to improve the way these agencies work and our relationship with those agencies. I guess there's an influence.
Oh, and Mr. Chair, I didn't want to interrupt you.
No, thoughts. Please.
Thank you. Mr. Chief.
My thought's pretty random anyway.
Mine are too.
Hard to interrupt.
Mr. Chief, when you suggested that when we hear from constituents as elected officials, that gives us some level of, did you intend to say oversight? Was that what you were pushing toward?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Flores, I'm not sure I'm saying oversight. What I'm just simply describing what my experience has been in the past, which was when a constituent had a problem with a certain type of practitioner, felt that they weren't being practicing properly, what their current concerns weren't being addressed by a board, they tend to go to their legislator for help, for assistance, for solutions, and the legislators tend to pick up their phone and call me. So, and I get that kind of input all the time, and then So that's what I was getting at.
Just a quick follow-up.
Yes,
I would agree that we pick up the phone and call someone, and usually it's somebody that maybe even in the governor's office, but that doesn't imply that we have an input or oversight. We're a facilitator for a public who is trying to find redress for a problem. So,
Chair Greenlick, Representative Flores, I think what I would say is the ultimate oversight authority that the legislature has is the ability to create or remove or eliminate a board. Yeah. They are creations of the legislature, and the legislature maintains that authority, and that's the ultimate oversight authority.
We sort of call information meetings, we do a variety of things, but I think our formal investigative authority and responsibility is about asking whether the statutes are correct and whether they need a change in statute. So we have that and we say, oh, well, we got to do something about this board, change statute 160.03. And, I mean, but that's an indirect, that's not a direct.
Mr. Chair, I think Charlie said it when he first sat down. He said that these are executive agencies and executive boards over executive agencies, and the selection process comes from the governor. And so, in any kind of business, the guy who hires you and fires you has the authority, and the governor, subject to whatever statutes might apply to the various boards, has the authority to name and to take people off from the board. We may pass statutes that give certain authority and so forth, but ultimately it's the governor who, if he gets unhappy with a director of an agency, finds ways for that director, of a board, to either resign or not get reselected or get taken off. And so until the governor's on
the election board, is that isn't the way the governor chose to do it. The governor aimed at the executive rather than aiming at the board. And that may have been right. It may be,
the Transportation Commission happened recently there.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying there are different ways that the governor can influence these boards, and for us to have oversight when we come, we're a part-time citizen legislature. We're not even staffed to do oversight, where you have full-time employees of the governor's executive branch who have that kind of staff. But we may need to, as a body, redefine or clearly define what it is that is expected from these boards, what kind of authority we want them to exercise, and that then also leads us into the discussion of who should be on these boards to accomplish that, and whether you should have a majority of those who are regulated on a board that's designed to regulate that industry, or should it be others that are outside. And so I think that we really control the policy as to what's expected, and the power and all of that, but ultimately it's going to be the governor, the executive branch, that enforces it.
Well, we could, and one of the things that I've been considering in the statute is we could put a statute in the public health statute that says the director of public health has a responsibility to review the actions of all these boards periodically and report to the governor on their conduct. I mean, I'm just making this up as I'm going along, but we could say, yeah, let's get specific about where that oversight is.
That's right.
Every board, the chair of every board reports to the director of public health, and the director of public health's job is to vet that and to report to the governor on the action of the board. I mean, we could say, let's get specific about this.
Yeah, what you're saying, Ben, is that the governor's office really is not geared to do oversight,
No. But
they are geared to respond to crisis. And so if you say it should be the governor, the head of DHS, now it becomes a budget item. He looks at his budget, say, okay, who can we do, who's going to do this, what kind of reports are going to make, and then it'll be up to the governor to respond to those reports, although we could also say a copy of which goes
to
the head of the committees or to the co-chairs or to the head of the Senate and the House and those kinds of things.
I think it'd be very useful to do something like that, to figure something like that out.
Representative Cannon.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Just to sort of add to this discussion, I recall hearing from Reese Saylors in the governor's office when we were looking at this last fall that she, I think her comment was that she would appreciate more direction in the statutes with respect to the purpose of these governing boards. You recall the purpose in statute is different from board to board. It's described somewhat differently. In some cases, it's silent, perhaps, on purpose. And clearly, if our conclusion and her conclusion is that the governor's office is primarily responsible, has the sort of ultimate authority and accountability for these agencies, but we're, as a legislative body, not being clear about what the purpose of these agencies is, that's an area for us, I think, to take up. And she mentioned specifically that the statute should enunciate the protection of the public as primary. It's the primary purpose of these boards. That's not currently the case in statute, and I think it's an issue that we should be taking up during this interim.
The governor mentioned that in his letter to the nursing board.
Yeah.
Janet Cote?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is off another topic, but I'm aware of other commissions that aren't on this list. There are lots of commissions, and there's a challenge of getting people to serve, but I know some places where people's terms are rolled over and rolled over and rolled over, even though they're only supposed to serve, you know, two full terms or whatever. You know, there might be the case where we have a board that really needs some new blood and the governor is just not willing to make any changes. If what happens when the governor doesn't, you know, essentially people have to roll off eventually, according to the statutes in many of these cases. What if that doesn't happen? Is he in, you know, outside, you know, and what do we do if that becomes the case?
Mr. Chair and Madam Vice Chair, I can tell you that the governor's policy is that he prefers to replace people who have served two full terms. So that's certainly his goal. If you've referenced the problem in finding additional folks to serve, sometimes that is an issue after two terms. As you also pointed out, some of these statutes require a new person on after two terms or four terms or what have you. So I think we definitely appreciate diversity. We want to make sure that there are more people involved and that they're really, these boards are functioning in a way that allows them to take a fresh look at the issues. But sometimes that's not always possible. I guess to the extent that there is a statutory requirement that a board turn over, that is a hard line. But it also might impair us from making sure the best person is in the position. So.
Or frankly, having it filled at all.
Yes.
You could have unique functioning boards, but thank you.
Well, Ms. Hollis, sir, Mr. Cheeks, thank you very much. I'm glad you're listening in on this, Charlie. I really do hope we can get an omnibus bill that will cover as many of these issues as we can achieve consensus on. That makes sense. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, do we get a sense that the boards themselves are paying attention to this conversation?
You are.
I know a few are.
When they thought I had in mind the combining of all the boards into a single board, they really were paying attention.
Okay.
Because they may be paying a little less attention right now.
Because these, you know, we talk about the role, what is the purpose of the board? And you know, clearly, in many cases, their goal is going to be to maintain the status quo, because their profession has a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. And politically, we're going to be swimming upstream. We may be bipartisanly swimming upstream against the professions, but we may be swimming upstream in some cases. And I hope that we have the fortitude and the political will in order, you know, to make the right decision for the protection of the public interest.
And to the extent we have at least two and sometimes three parties involved in this, in the one case the board and its members or its chair, then the executive, which in somehow my impression is of all executives, the main job is to manipulate their board. I mean, that's what executives do. So there's the executives, and then there's the deputy attorney generals that are involved. And this, to a certain extent, and we're asking who do they represent? And I mean, I think all three of those communities are very much are very interested. We're trying to get the boards to talk to us as much as we can. Tomorrow we're going to have representatives of boards. Is that right, Sandy?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Several of them will be conference calling because they're calling from Bend. One gentleman's on the road, so we're going to try and catch him on his drive or at some stop. But we've got some public members and some retired board members, and there's a couple that I have not heard back from, but I'm hoping to get a good diverse group of folks to speak to the position.
So we're really looking for the board to participate in any way they want to.
Mr. Chair, in this conversation about the purpose of the board, I hope we not forget that a primary purpose is to watch out for the well-being of the citizens.
Yes, to protect
because
the public
they're
safety.
There. Remember a conversation we had with the Board of Medical Examiners? Mm-hmm. And this was a while back, and the discussion was, are they there to watch out for the citizens, or are they to protect applicants who want to become doctors, who at that time, and it's changed, could find out before they're about to be rejected that they're going to get rejected and withdraw their application only to protect that person so they can go to someplace else. And maybe they won't be as thorough there and they get, you know, so subjecting the citizens to that. I understand that has been changed, and I was grateful that the board found it appropriate to change. But as we look at what their purposes are, I would hope that we would put at the top of the list to help assure that the safety and well-being of Oregon citizens are maintained in this area.
That should be the first article of any statement of purpose. But they also have to balance because we're helped the extent to which they can enhance the profession and the behavior of the profession. That really helps society, and that's something that's very much in our best interest. Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Maurer for the imagery that he provided during this interesting discussion, because I now see us all swimming upstream into a big hornet's nest. So,
I think that's a good place to close this session. I'll close the informational meeting and adjourn the committee.